Call to order the meeting of the Safety and Security Committee. First order of business, as always, is a little safety reminder. I'll call on Jim Doherty for that.
Thank you, Chairman Downey. Just first off, on the emergency exits, in the event the fire alarm would go off, you'd see the strobe and the audio alarm go off. Ask that folks would exit out the door back here behind the meeting room, make a right go out the front doors of the Jackson Graham Building, across the street to the lawn of the Building Museum, where we would assemble there. If I could, continuing with the safety contact, with the beautiful weather forecasted for this weekend, our safety contact will be outdoor grilling safety. Outdoor grilling is one of the most popular ways to cook food, but a grill placed too close to anything that can burn is a fire hazard. They can also be very hot, causing burn injuries. Fire departments respond to an average of 7,900 home fires involving grills each year, with 3,200 of those being structure fires. 33% of home grill structure fires start on an exterior balcony or an unenclosed porch. If you follow these simple steps, then you'll be on your way to safe grilling. Only use grills outdoors. Place them away from the home and away from deck railings. Keep them out from under eaves and overhanging branches. Keep children and pets away from the grill area, and never leave your grill unattended. So remember, there's no better way to celebrate summer than barbecue outdoors, so please follow these steps to keep your family safe from grilling accidents or injuries. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I started my grilling last weekend, but I was in, I think, relative safety, but we'll check it out again this weekend. We have, the agenda is in front of you. Any questions, comments, changes to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll accept that. And we have the minutes of the meeting from March 24th. Entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Any comments or questions on the minutes? If not, without objection, the minutes are adopted. This month, we have only a safety focus, so we'll be hearing from the Chief on security next month. And as we progress through our review of safety procedures and safety follow-up through the corrective action plans and the like, we've several times touched on the issue of hazard analysis, which is really a key component of a good safety program, that you know and deal with things in a priority order based on what could have the most serious consequences. Not that anything isn't worth looking at, but a priority should be those things that have substantial future negative ramifications. Thought today we have the time to do this, and I've asked Jim to present for us what that process is about and where we stand with respect to our analysis. We heard last month that the many corrective action plan items that we have been looked at and placed in a particular place in the spectrum of hazard analysis, but I thought it would be helpful to have a better understanding of what that process is. So, Jim, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you again, Chairman Downey, members of the board. Good morning. This morning, we're, as Chairman Downey mentioned, allocating all the time briefing the committee on our safety progress, particularly the hazard management process. As a reminder, next month at the May meeting will be dedicated to the Transit Police and their quarterly report, and at the June meeting, the committee members and general public will be receiving an updated briefing from the Tri-State Oversight Committee. But to begin today's report, I would like to provide a context of what I will be addressing. The three main areas to provide information to the board committee members for April are the hazard management process and how it applies to the open findings and recommendations received from various internal and external sources. And as our usual, we will be providing the updated safety statistics. In our past meetings, we mainly focused on the type and status of audits and our inspections, number of open and closed corrective action plans, our progress and statistics. And so today, we would like to spotlight and provide the committee members additional information on what is the hazard management process, the importance of using it to prioritize our identified hazards, and how this tool will assist us in making Metro a safer place to work and a system to ride. The Tri-State Oversight Committee, under the authority of the United States Department of Transportation Federal Transit Administration, requires Metro to develop, and by the way, in all transit properties that have rail systems to develop, document, and administer a hazard management process, or HMP. The HMP requires transit properties to define the approach, specify the process of identification, and prioritization for elimination or control. It is a proven and applied process used by many agencies, not just transit, and even specifically the military. The HMP was not systematically or consistently applied at Metro in the past, as it really isn't at many transit agencies. I serve on the Transit Rail Advisory Committee on Safety, and this was a discussion yesterday, something new to get to actually applying hazard management to operations and maintenance above and beyond design. So often we do preliminary hazard analyses in a design mode, but then in operations and maintenance, so we'll be presenting them actually additional information down the road. But before moving on to the process, I'd like to take a moment to define a hazard. A hazard is any real or potential condition that can cause injury, illness, or death, damage to or loss of a system, equipment, property, or damage to the environment. Hazards are created basically in two ways, through a hazardous act, and that's an act that may endanger human life or property. An example of a hazardous act could be an operator operating under the influence of some substance. A hazardous condition is a condition that may endanger human life or property. An example of a hazardous condition would be tiles protruding from a level surface, creating an unlevel surface. And as always, we try to apply what in the safety world we call our three E's, which are to engineer out, educate, and enforce. Preferably, we want to engineer out a hazard in the design. But when it does occur and we have it in operations, then we need to look at how we're going to address it accordingly. This slide represents that identifying hazards can and do come from multiple sources, from our external audits to internal inspections to calls placed to the safety hotline. The key is the ability to capture that information into a centralized system in order to track and address the hazard. And certainly if you look at everything from either experience, system audits, accidents, anytime we have an accident, we conduct an accident investigation, look at the corrective actions there that could be a potential hazard, the reliability, proficient safety hotline, we've talked about that. We have the employee safety hotline that's really turned out to be really a pretty good tool to feed information, and that's where employees can report a hazard or any safety concern that they have the opportunity to remain confidential also. We don't share their name. In fact, they're not even required to give their name, but we still look at the hazard that's there. And then through formal hazard processes or customer complaints, and then certainly local safety committees where hazards can get introduced. So there's quite a number of ways to identify a hazard. This flowchart actually identifies the hazard management process, and as I mentioned, it's based on a military standard known as 882C, and it's been around quite a long time, and that's basically identifying from cradle to grave, or from identification to resolution, how a hazard is addressed. And a segment of the hazard management process is the ability to develop a hazard resolution matrix for each of the findings or recommendations that we've received. Using the matrix to categorize the hazards allows a systematic prioritization which permits identification of the most serious hazards and the ability to resolve these serious conditions first with our available resources. This is the standard hazard resolution matrix, one that we apply here. This has been accepted by the Federal Transit Administration, even for the audit that they conducted of WMATA in the past, and the Tri-State Oversight Committee has also accepted the use of this process. So this is one that's in our approved system safety program plan, and it provides the process, the responsibility, and the purpose. And in your appendix, each of the committee members, you'll find an additional information on the frequency of occurrence and hazard categories. Metro has run all of the findings and recommendations through this process. And as I mentioned, this allows us the ability to focus our time, energy, and scarce resources on the most critical ones first. However, all will eventually be closed. We're addressing all of them, and we're working on closing them as quickly as we can through the prioritization process. And examples that would be, from the previously, our roadway worker protection program as an unidentified unacceptable hazard, and developing programs to regularly review driver's license as an undesirable. and this ensures all employees are familiar with the System Safety Program Plan as acceptable by review of the Executive Safety Committee.
Chair, can I ask a question going back to that chart? I can intuitively see the difference on frequency, frequent, probable, occasional, but what are the features that put a particular hazard in catastrophic or critical or marginal?
If we look at it for the catastrophic, is that it can result in basically death or very serious injury. Mm-hmm. Frequently, is does it occur on a daily basis and routine? So that puts it into a 1A. If something happens on a daily basis, can result in death or system loss, and that puts it into the frequent catastrophic 1, or what we would call a 1A mm-hmm. category, just due to that routine exposure. And to be honest, we had two that were in that category that dealt with the Roadway Worker Protection Program, and actually through the work that the operations folks have done and the team at WMATA, the talk actually just closed those out this past Tuesday, April 26th. So those were the only two, and they have now been addressed.
We no longer have anything in Category 1A.
Correct.
And generally, what percentage of our overall open plans are in the red?
Actually, at this point, with all of them prior to any of the closing, we had 16%, or a total of 41. And the majority of those have been addressed or satisfactorily mitigated through a workaround condition. But the majority were in a roadway worker protection. As we know, we had the worker fatalities.
I'm not sure I understand your answer to this question. How many are still in the red?
At this point in time, I'd have to get, I believe it's...
Okay. Does the next chart show that in color code? I mean, I think Mr. Downey is heading in the direction.
No, it shows something different.
Okay.
Well, we have, you know, if I could say, there are still, you know, with the closure, which we did close 11 corrective actions just this past Tuesday with the talk, and don't know exactly which ones fell in that, but I can tell you, like, the rollback protection on the rail cars were in the red, not as a 1A, you know, in that case, you know, if we go to the rollback protection, that would, well, fell into a 1C, and most of the NTSB ones. Yes, sir.
Could you go to the next chart? I've been reading ahead, obviously. All right, so this tells you, based on the color code, what categories they're in or not?
No, sir.
This is,
the green are closed, right. The red are open.
Okay. And that leads to my follow-on question. One of the useful charts to me would be, you know, the element of risk, and you've certainly identified in the matrix what's the high priority versus what's the lesser priority. Not that they're all not important, but one's higher than the other. At some point, I would like to see, you know, some gradation of each of those open ones. In other words, what level of risk are we at in each of those open categories, whether the old ones or the new ones? And that would be more useful to me from an oversight point of view. And that kind of relates also to the point that we raised some time ago, and I believe April or May is when you're launching the master system of electronic monitoring of all the hazards in one report. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is that ready to be viewed at this point, or is it done?
I was just told actually this morning, and I haven't seen it myself, that we have loaded in the hazards.
So it's imminent. It's imminent.
Yes, sir.
That being said, as part of that reporting system, some indication of the level of hazard risk would be very helpful to us.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question on the last chart again, if we could just go back to the last one. In the occasional category, if you slide all the way across to negligible 4C, you end up with acceptable without review. So you go from yellow, undesirable, all the way to not reviewing at all, something that happens occasionally. Can you explain what would be in 4C and why, if we have a hazard that occurs occasionally, whether it's negligible or not, but if it's happening on occasion, why wouldn't we review that?
Oddly enough, is an area that a light bulb would be out that creates a dark area, and the light bulb needs replaced. So it's a matter of, it's more of a maintenance function. So it doesn't take a lot of discussion. It's a standard routine maintenance. You replace the light bulb or something in an area where someone's concerned that due to a bulb being out that they're susceptible to an assault or something
like that.
So
there's nothing that is malfunctioning that would be in that category. This is solely a routine maintenance issue, 4C.
typically, where there could be the potential for injury, but it is routine maintenance. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. Going back two slides, I think it is. Our weakness in the past has been hazard identification. The employee survey that was done a year and a half ago. Less than a year. Time flies when you're having a good time. Showed, I've forgotten the percentage of employees who were reluctant or did not feel obligated or compelled to report hazardous conditions. If you don't have good data coming in, this grid isn't as useful as it probably should be. One of the measures ought to be over time, I think, is the willingness and aggressiveness of employees reporting what they perceive to be hazards or safety issues, and a recognition of those efforts on behalf of the employees. I think the authority has had, on occasion, a reputation of smacking people around a bit for stepping out of line about being troublemakers about reporting hazardous issues. Changing that culture, changing those values, and recognizing people who do it, and getting that percentage up higher about willingness to report, maybe setting a target like 75% acceptance, 85% acceptance, or willingness to report hazardous conditions would be, I think, a meaningful front-end target, and then measuring that through future employee surveys.
And I believe certainly that, you know, we've made a lot of headway since the survey's been done. We're averaging about 30, you know, calls or inputs, if you will, into the safety hotline. Recently, just even at the Executive Safety Committee meeting just Tuesday of this week, we actually did present on an employee that did bring up a hazardous condition where we had an area on the roof of one of our facilities that employees have to walk within 10 feet of the edge, and it was identified that there wasn't a railing, and with a strong wind, the potential to be blown off the roof existed, hadn't happened. And within, I know it was within 60 to 90 days, actually, from that hazard being reported, the railing was installed and addressed. So right now we do have employees pretty much, and I'd look at Ann, about 30 a month into the safety hotline of employees that are reporting concerns, to where before they were, wasn't too frequently. So hopefully the majority are addressing with their supervision and their management, but if they feel they either can't or they don't, you know, they're not getting action, then they're reporting to that. And we do follow up. We track all calls, all inputs of hazards to closure. And that's actually what we're even working with a safety hotline. Then when the box is checked for a hazard, then it moves it into the hazard management system, the electronic system, sir, that you'd mentioned earlier, and actually everything with the interface and the integration of those systems, we believe it seems to be appearing very beneficial. We will be providing a demonstration later this afternoon to the Federal Transit Administration group that conducted the safety review of that, and it's our anticipation that we may have a few more items closed as a result of that and other activities that have occurred.
And maybe for a future meeting, it would be good to have a brief on how that, what the trends are and how that is being used, because it was a key part of our effort to improve the safety culture.
Mr. Doherty, is there a plan to repeat the survey of employees to get at the culture issue?
Yeah. When we did the survey the first time around, the folks who did it, the experts on it, advised us that it probably be about 2 years before you should come back to see measurable results. Mm-hmm. So that's my intent.
Other questions, Jim? Not go on with the brief.
Okay, and here is our updated bar chart that you know, certainly appreciate that you've reviewed, because we believe that it does, you know, tell a good story in a lot of the activity, and this reflects the number of open caps. And certainly what we're proud of is that there's only 18 remaining out of the original 256. Now, we, this doesn't, actually, the red bar now shows you from the 2010 triennial audit. And again, all of those findings have been incorporated into the hazard rating system, and that's then how we'll look at deploying our resources, and some of which we'd say is, you know, the 2004, the open caps, which deal with the external door handles for emergency service access. Mr. Kubicek's group is working to get those installed. I believe now they're at close to 200 installed on the rail cars, so we're moving forward on that. I know that's old. We're looking at the old, the new, what we can do, anything that, that hasn't been addressed. So we're working with that. We're actually now also going to be meeting with the National Transportation Safety Board periodically, providing them data that shows that we're making the progress, and they have agreed that with that, providing that verification, that they would consider closing some of their open items. So we're working with
them. And were they not to be comfortable with where we are and anything, we would hear from them?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Oh, no doubt. So, but it's, we're working aggressively to close out, you know, any of the findings. On our, certainly the, as you'd seen last month, this is the new corrective action plan breakdown of where they've come from, whether they're internal or external. Certainly, as you can see, you know, from the chart with the new caps, and this report doesn't reflect the ones that the TALC has agreed to close out just at Tuesday's meeting. Since we don't have the update on that for your board presentation, we certainly will next month. But it shows the TALC comprises 45% of the corrective actions. Through our own internal safety auditing, we're identifying 32%, you know, in our own audits, which also we're caught up. We're in a good state with our requirements under the 49 CFR 659 standard, which is the state safety oversight requirement. And then we have the other. We're including, the general manager asked to make sure that we include the inspector general's, you know, findings related to safety, as well as the BTX for the escalators, and that's also in the...
And the investigations category is where we've had an incident, and we've investigated it and created recommendations from that.
Yes, sir, and the
so
TALC has been approved.
If you do the math, the safety board plus the TALC is 51%, and our basically variety of internally generated is 49%. So we're not just responding to others. We're basically leading.
Thank you. That's correct.
Yes.
Thank you. Just a little more information to give me some context. On the first pie chart, that's the distribution of the
all
source
of the
identification of the issues. Is that correct?
Of hazards or of corrective actions that we need to take. We affectionately call it CAPS or corrective action plans. That is the totality, if you will, and then the other gives you the breakdown.
Okay. I get, so my question as it relates to particularly the 45% strikes me, and maybe I'm misinterpreting the chart, strikes me as an inordinately large number of identifications that are sourced from external as opposed to our own internal observations. I mean, can you give me a sense of what types of issues are embodied in that 45%?
Certainly. That was the 45 is that's the TOCS, the Tri-State Oversight Committee.
Right, I understand.
Every 3 years they do a triennial audit.
Right.
And that audit was just done in late 2010. They actually had identified 127 items total. Of those, there were 36 deficiencies and 91 areas of concerns. Areas of concerns could be broken tiles,
right,
if you will, where, you know, the deficiencies, and that's one of the things that actually we believe are submitting out there is our, we submit a report to the Tri-State Oversight Committee on a monthly basis, typically the last day of the month, that report goes out. So if we were to look at, just give me a quick second, I have to find, it's up to about 50 pages now. Let me see, Darren, can you get an example real quick of one of the deficiencies from the TALC 2010
final? Yeah, probably, I didn't mean to take you too far down the detail path. I guess my larger question is, are those issues that are typically that we didn't pick up, or are they issues that we didn't necessarily believe were safety issues, but the TALC felt that they were, and so therefore they became safety issues, hazard issues? Is that, can you, is it,
could
is that an overgeneralization?
It certainly, it could be both. The one that we would look at that's being, that's being addressed through maintenance, and with our group of the safety staff going out and doing the internal safety audits, they're focused on the 21 elements that we're required to audit to, for everything from safety programs to, coming up later this month, procurement, as well as operations for rail transportation, rail car maintenance. There's 21 elements as a component through that we're required to complete through the system safety program plan. Don't mean to make this a long answer to your question, but it's some that we may not have noticed. There's some that we may have noticed that's actually in the mill. But typically when the talk comes in, they spent about 25 days, right, Rob, I think, with us in June, and with a team of several individuals, and cover the entire rail system, looking, you know, for whatever findings that are out there. And then, but we also do our own, we do our own inspections, and that's where ours come up, and through our own internal safety audits. Does that answer your question? Sorry, that's a long-winded answer.
I would argue if we had had a chart like this a couple of years ago, we would see 100% of all of the things coming from the outside, and that shouldn't be. I think as we do more internally, I would expect to see somewhat fewer from the outside, but I never expect to see none. There's no level of safety at which you could not improve, and that's one of the things we get the benefit of a second opinion on what's going on.
I just wanted to add to that. A year ago, if we had done this, when we did not have the strength and safety department and leadership that we now have, I would suspect the pie chart would have been much more to the top. We've increased the staff by about 40% safety. Importantly, strengthened the skill levels. And as a result, we have been doing much more robust internal audits during the past year than had been done before. So I agree with Mort. Over time, I would like to see the proportion go more to the internal than the outside talk.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Downey?
Yes.
This is a case, too, where the hazard assessment matters, right?
Yes.
The point that Mr. Giancola was making before of these things break down into those levels of hazard is also a useful thing for us to understand. How many of these are red? You know, and that the talk identified that need immediate action that you might have missed, would be a concerning thing to me if there were a lot of red ones, or even if there was one red one. But if they're mostly in the yellow area, that's a different story. And we talked about this the last time we got this report, that part of what's going on is we need to understand where our risk is, more the board does more clearly, and adding that layer to this would actually be quite helpful.
And that's what, because right now until we apply the closure and what's been agreed upon through the talk, there were 41 items in the red, in all the red categories together.
That came from these various sources.
Came from all these various sources of audits that could be not having the proper personal protective equipment, possibly. You know, a lot of different areas that are there, but I assure you, all the red ones are being addressed, you know, and some are closed out.
I also think we should speak to the relationship between TOC and the safety organization prior and now, because that is more the differences that we're able to identify, investigate, and those two are critical in working together.
I would just say that the description a year ago was that, or year and a half ago, was that I'd sort of describe it as an adversarial relationship, and one in which communication was difficult. During that course of the year, we jointly negotiated a memorandum of understanding, and it's nice, you know, to have something in paper, but more importantly, what came out of that and the discussions was a better understanding of the role of each party. And we culminated that, I guess it was last December, was it, or something like that, where we had a partnership meeting, or maybe early this year, a partnership meeting, which, again, continued to build this relationship between us and the TOC so that it's much more of a partnership. We still can improve on it, but it's come quite a ways, I think. And I think the TOC would agree with that.
Sorry about that. Mr. Bassett's not here because we're having the continuation. This is day two of the TRACS committee, as I'd mentioned, the Transit Rail Advisory Committee on Safety that was put together through the Secretary of Transportation, the FTA. Today's day two, and when I leave here, I'll be going back over there to join that group. But actually, one of the things that was one of the working papers that the administrator gave us is to develop what would be the ideal effective state safety oversight agency, but or organization. And I believe we've been working, you know, very hard to promote that relationship. We've already had we meet monthly with the TOC in a formal meeting setting. We have what we call a CAPTURE meeting, which is a corrective action planning, the rest of the acronym, but it's to work on, it's a working group, if you will, to close out corrective actions. There's one this afternoon to discuss where we're at in closing out findings from previous accidents. So we're working very, very closely, as Ms. Hudgens had mentioned, with the TOC, and provided them workspace and the safety offices if they needed, as well as the FTA. And so it's certainly, I think, a much, much better working relationship. And they attend the Executive Safety Committee also with us and have an opportunity for input and comment and hear what we're sharing with the rest of the executive staff and others.
And we have a quarterly briefing at this committee from the TOC. So if they didn't agree with you, we'd hear from them.
You certainly would.
If you recall, last month they were pretty positive in what they had to say. Yes, Downs.
I know it doesn't fit on the agenda right now, but one of the things that people are coming to accept is that extraordinarily rare events with incredibly thin chances of happening, if you wait long enough, they'll happen.
Black swans.
The black swans of, and in the context of safety, they don't get reported because they're not even seen as legitimate issues. The aviation industry is now starting to develop much better tools to try and tease out what are potentially catastrophic events that have an odds of millions to one against it ever happening, but they do happen. Planning for things like what would happen if the top of a 737 peeled off at 35,000 feet. How do you mitigate those? How do you inspect for them? How do you test them? Ultimately, the things that prove catastrophic for us have been things that we didn't think were possible. Ghost trains in the control system, thinking ultimately this is a mechanical process. It deals with reportables. It deals with known visible threats. Thinking about the reality of the things that are inconceivable in the system and trying to tease out what the vulnerabilities are and how you might look at those are kind of the end state of sophistication about this kind of analysis, I think.
Being able to deal with the unknown unknowns.
Yes.
Former Secretary.
It's certainly, you know, we do, you know, at this point in time, we've been catching up, I believe, a whole lot with the past, but certainly it's one of the things that we want to do looking forward, the what-if scenarios as we do emergency planning and drills and exercises along that line from not only the security perspective, but from a safety perspective. And I believe we're starting that transitional period, and I know that Mr. Kubitschek's group looks at various different things, you know, that are out there potentially on the rail. That's we get more involved in the safety certification process, if you will, safety and security certification, which helps us in trying to vet those potential unknowns before you build a system. And that's one of the things that we're looking at as an industry. What can we do to try and identify before it happens, like the 737, and hopefully we're able to catch that through preventative maintenance and through our inspections and through our audits. So it's I can't tell you we're perfect, but I think we're moving at a pretty quick speed, and we're trying to stay ahead of an event.
And some of that, I think, does have to be at an industry level, not just an agency level. If everybody who has an interest in it looks at it, somebody will have a light bulb go off that, gee, it could happen.
Yes.
Okay. Statistics?
Yes, sir. And typically, as we've done in the past month, This provides the safety statistics for the month of February 2011. As you recall, we're in line with the Performance Office reporting now. And just I'd like to highlight a couple of slides and, as always, certainly do my best to answer any questions that you'd have. First slide is the key performance indicator for the employee injury rate. And as you can see, you know, from this slide, that February is better than the previous month. And this, again, goes to the 200,000 hours that we've talked about, you know, for employees that have worked 200,000 hours. And it's one of the two key performance indicators that we said we'll bring back to the committee each month as a way to measure and track our performance. And, you know, as I mentioned, February is a better month for us. There were 29 fewer injuries than the previous month or for the month of January. And with February 2011, the 42 injuries was for a rate of 5.16 injuries per 200,000 hours worked. And where we're looking at that that target of 5, we are just a little bit above that target at this point in time. And we'll continue to address the issues through the local safety committees and through the corrective action plans.
Mr. Giancola.
In previous reports, we've seen kind of a comparison, I don't know, not necessarily like shops to be compared to, but of each shop and how their injury rate is progressing, and certainly the rates of some shops were higher than others. Are we going to see that kind of report in the future, or has that kind of been eliminated from this report?
It's actually certainly what you want. We've been focusing, you know, the recommendations have been to go with the key performance indicators.
The purpose of those reports, I thought, were, you know, are we targeting those particular divisions or shops for special programs or other kinds of actions to hopefully reduce the rates and certainly try to at least, to some degree, get those rates down to at least at or below the national averages, because I think in some cases they were above the national averages. I don't know whether you wanted to comment on that.
Well, we can focus on that in the Executive Safety Committee, but we certainly can provide it in the appendix here so you can review it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, and likewise, the other purpose was to spotlight and highlight extraordinary divisions that didn't have issues, because there were certainly some that raised challenges, but there were also a great deal in there that had a remarkably good safety record, and we need to be applauding those as well and encouraging that.
The data categorizes all injuries, and every injury is important, regardless of the source or why. But do you distill injuries as a result of hazards versus those that are random and totally unrelated to maintenance or operations of the system from a hazard standpoint? And how does that data illuminate this?
Okay, it's not actually, as you're aware, provided in this chart. If there is a hazard, if someone is injured due to a hazard, yes, then we look at that. The ones that, you know, it's discussed at the local safety committees, we bring them up at the executive safety committee meeting, which meets every month. And one of the things certainly to note is we did have 25 of our facilities that for the past month actually had zero injuries. So as far as with your, you know, your comment that we're looking at the hazards, yes, if there's a hazard, we look at the hazard. Actually, we get the injury reports. Our risk management group looks at those. But I can't give you an exact breakdown at this point in time of the employee injuries resulting from a hazard, because in employee injuries, we get into whether it's an unsafe act or an unsafe condition. So is it a facility condition, or is it something that an employee didn't do through following a procedure? And most of them, for the most part, thank God, are non-serious injuries. But
no, I understand that. I guess, but a meaningful statistic for me would be how many injuries result from a hazard, an identifiable hazard that would be part of our maintenance or corrective action program, versus an injury that occurs simply because it occurs in a random state. And I guess if that is not a meaningful statistic over time, then fine, you could describe to me why that's not the case, but it would seem from an oversight perspective that if we're having injury reports, which is important, we should understand how many of those result from hazardous conditions versus those that are not, I think.
What we do in an investigation of any injury is determine what the root cause of the injury is. And it could be a physical condition, as Jim mentioned, or it could be not following the rules. but we get down to why the injury occurred. I don't know that there, I would classify anything as a random cause. There's usually some reason why injury occurred, and we have to deal with that, whether it's additional training because employees aren't following the proper procedures or because there's a physical hazard and we have to correct it. So I don't know that. I would normally consider anything random.
Moving on, this provides the KPI for the customer injury rate, and this is per customer injury per million trips. I'm sorry, per million trips, and this includes all customers on bus, metro access, on board the trains, as well as escalator and elevator incidents. And there were 10 fewer injuries than the previous month from January 2011, and February was better than the last month for the same time period last year. And I believe certainly was due to the weather. I know it was bad in both areas, but the year before was a little bit worse in 2010 than 2011. And for February 2011, 43 customer injuries were reported for a rate of 1.66 injuries per million trips. So, January 2011, 53 customers were injured, and we had a rate of 2.08, so we are down. Certainly slightly of 10 injuries reported from one month to the next. And certainly no injury in any case is acceptable, but the rate is relatively low at 1.66. Questions?
And we have one incident to review.
I'd like to certainly provide the board a quick briefing on an incident that occurred this past April 20th, 2011. This is where a 52-year-old patron walked directly into an open hatch at about 6:30 a.m. The patron sustained an injury to her right knee and a laceration from her right to her left side of her chin. She was treated and discharged at George Washington Hospital on April 22nd. The escalator was being used as a walker due to the ongoing maintenance to replace the step rollers. And the Ellis technicians, or the elevator and escalator technicians, had logged into the station kiosk log at 11:30 p.m. and logged out on a job ticket at 2 o'clock a.m. We did check the CCTV cameras in the area, and none of the cameras actually displayed any video that showed this area. There was a camera, but it's provided by the Pentagon, and then they've installed an awning in front of it. So that camera may have been useful, but certainly with the awning blocking the view, we didn't have that. The safety department did investigate this incident, and a root cause of the incident was the failure of the elevator escalator technicians to close the access hatch or to protect the openings on all sides, you know, from that particular event. And I'd like to call on Mr. Kubitschek to speak to the actions that's been taken since this incident occurred.
Presently at this time, some of the actions that we've undertaken is basically also differentiate that this access cover, you can see, is really more similar to a manhole cover than it is an actual, you know, elevator, escalator piece of equipment. We have a lot of these locations throughout the agency based on these designs. So one of our first things, by practice, this thing is supposed to be kept closed all the time. The number one thing, we've had staff notices, we've had regular meetings with all of our shifts and employees to reinforce, you know, the importance of keeping these things closed whenever somebody's not around and working it. The other thing is to take the necessary steps to differentiate on the way that we should really barricade these things if, in fact, they are left open. We're probably going to go more in line with our plant maintenance approach, where we put a little bit more coverage around it. It really should be covered around from all respective sides, but the primary focus is that it really should be kept closed.
Any questions? Yes.
I guess I'm confused that one, the technician logged in and then the technician logged out. And when the technician logged out, what's asked of that technician as they do so? Do they simply get off the system, put their time in? Or do they have to go through some sort of checklist to say that they've met all the safety requirements?
Well, on this particular effort right in here, again, the standard practice is that hatch, as you see right there, it should have been closed.
By
the same individuals that were working this location.
So if he's logged out, the expectation is logging out would have involved closing the hatch.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm trying to explore a more proactive approach to ensure that the rule that we assume would have been followed would have to be followed as part of ending the process that they're in. And you're saying that it's a standard practice, but it seems, again, if I go back to our discussion about the hazard of that practice not being followed, is there something more proactively we can do? For example, let me use the simple one in which when you're trying to log on to a new system of credit or something, and they say, do you agree? Giving you your rules that you're going to follow, and you don't get beyond that window of saying you will follow, you acknowledge you will follow these procedures before you move forward. And I'm just wondering why the log-off system doesn't say something about that last message, or am I missing something here?
Okay. Again, we are reviewing the practices and procedures of what's taking place. The information they work off of the kiosk, is old. We're looking to try to get media, programmed into an electronic database. That wasn't prevalently done here for many, many years. So we are transitioning into that phase. But again, our main component, main concern is we have stations, configurations throughout our system that have manhole covers close, farther away, based on the system design. And we really need to differentiate between the barricade of an escalator and its actual work that's undertaking versus a potential manhole cover. And the standardization also across the board is that, and why we reference the plant maintenance is because if we have an opening that is anywhere in the station and stuff, we really need to be as consistent as possible on how we approach that basically maintenance application to warn our customers and to make sure that it's consistent among our employees, because that's the other thing. We're looking for consistency on everything that we're trying to do instead of one group doing it one way, one group doing it another way.
And in this circumstance, I assume this is an employee who's working, he or she, through 2 a.m., probably not supervised, right?
That's correct. We basically
really are reliant on the employee fulfilling all parts.
Yeah,
of the
we job. We have work crews that are deployed, throughout the system. We just don't have the supervision to basically accompany everybody at every location.
So process is really critical in terms
that is
of
correct.
Getting a job done. Yes.
Just out of curiosity, I noticed that the station probably just reopened in the morning. Does the station manager do a walkthrough of the station just to kind of look at these issues before the station opens?
Yes, there is a certain level of review by the station manager, and they would walk by, they would look at this. Again, as you can see, we've got a barricade that really does not have any locking points. And again, this is a picture that was taken maybe after the fact. This is something that could be easily moved by an employee, a customer, or anything else. And so what we really have to do is focus on the hatch. What do we do to basically have some type of, secure device that has some type of interlocking features as well as some signage to ensure that, we address that properly.
Yes. Yeah.
Not related to this incident, in your actual report, after the data, there's a couple sheets called Introduction of New Measures. And, are we changing entirely the whole system of measurement, or is it just a few tweaking here and there, and you just wanted to give us a summary of all these new measures? This is toward the end of the report.
This is actually what is
Introduction of New Measures is the title.
It's the measures we're looking at with our key performance indicators with the Office of Performance, and there's the measures and the general manager's direction of where we're moving forward.
No, I like the idea. I just wanted to know whether they're all new or not.
Actually were introduced a few months ago.
Oh, were they? Okay.
And this was the explanation. These are the ones that are key performance indicators at the agency-wide.
I just got confused by the title then.
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry
about that. We'll take the introduction. Now that we've had, this has been our first, I believe, formal report that we've had, so we'll certainly strike that out, but it gives you an idea in here of the, of those two measures that I'll call that we're reporting out on safety, how we come up with those numbers and what the target is. So.
Yeah, I was wondering if we could spend a moment in honor of Mr. Yule and some recent incidents to perhaps get an update, because I've heard mixed stories out there about what happened with the recent slip on the floor tiles, and also what, if anything, we're doing to look at those materials. I've heard varying reports in the media and from riders about what's happening relative to the floor tiles, but I haven't heard anything official from the staff, and I'm wondering if we could take a minute to kind of give us an update on what the situation is there and what, if anything, we're doing so that we officially know.
Okay, this is a multi-layered answer here, so I'll be as brief as possible. First of all, the new station platform work that we are undertaking, example, White Flint, Shady Grove, Rockville, we are going with a larger precast panel. Basically, it's, I should say, a stone in nature. Its adhesion is much more aggressive than what we have. We're getting away from the smaller tile. Mr. Giancola's station at Tacoma was the inaugural station that has this application applied, and we've had it in place for several years. It's proved to work out very nicely, and so as part of the Red Line segment contract, for example, we will be replacing all of the tiles accordingly. Now, the recent condition of what we're in, there was a huge effort, at least what staff has told me, probably about 10 to 12 years ago, where there was a lot of tile work and stuff that was done on the exterior of that. Typically, you know, you get maybe 6 to 8 years at best on tile. There has not been a big focus on tile on the exterior applications. What we're in the process of doing now is basically assessing all of the locations that we have, and we will be spending the rest of the summer installing, you know, new tile on a much grander scale than what we've seen here before. But we are basically at the end. The agency's gotten past its life cycle of the existing tile that it's had in the stations and stuff that are exposed.
So I just if I may follow up just real briefly, are you, when we're doing major station rehabs then, is that the trigger point to do that, and is a part, it's already a part of the capital plan to
yes,
do
it's
that,
already it's already built funded. Into it.
And so when we see major station renovations or rehab projects, we should expect to see this new tile being rolled out throughout the system.
Where we're, say for instance, where we're demolishing like platform edges and everything else, this new product that we're using is probably close to an inch thick. So not only is its size, it's also very good, but it's also its overall weight to keep it in place. Whenever we look at the standard traditional tile, it's probably only a quarter inch thick, and then you're like in little six-inch segments and stuff. So, yes, you can go up there to Shady Grove or to Rockville or to White Flint, and you will see what's, you know, being implemented across the board. And then, as for example, the orange and blue line segment contract, which we've got up and running, that will be the next phase, and that approach and philosophy is already, you know, already being applied.
Okay, thank you.
But in that will take years and years.
Yes.
System-wide, we are going to pay more attention to tile replacement.
Yeah, and that's also part of the reason why this summer, now since the temperatures are warmer, you know, you can't really lay tile during the winter months. And if you've noticed, there was a lot of where we were using some type of a grout patch. Instead of trying to throw the existing tile and stuff back there, knowing that it was not going to adhere, they're trying to use a patch. It's unsightly. It's not necessarily the desired, you know, product that we really want to use. But at least whenever they do that, we can smooth out the finish, make the patch, and then, you know, continue to move forward. But we've got to go through every station that is above ground. And like I said, it'll be going around the rest of the summer. So you'll see work where major rehabs, where we're doing and going through a more industrial application, but we're also going through a maintenance effort, you know, replacing these areas. And that would also be where we have the bumpy tiles and stuff on the edge as well. You know, so it's not only just the overall tile. It's the bumpy edge, and if you've been like through Metro Center and everything else, of course, we have a lot of cones and stuff, but if you look down, you can see every place where they're working at, even in those locations where, you know, it hasn't even been treated or anything else, and they're working out there every night, you know.
Yeah, Mr. McKay, second question addressed the thing about the tiles being installed during the major rehabs, and I wanted to emphasize that, but if you haven't seen the tiles, they are in the rear section of the Tacoma station. They are also high friction tiles, where in fact you know they have a gritty feel to it, and they're not slippery like the current tiles. So I think it'll be a major improvement. It'll be interesting over time to see what kind of wear, you know, how long they last, and the kind of wear they get as well. So I'm sure you're incorporating that in your future analysis, Mr. Kubitschek.
Absolutely. The less we have to touch it, the more money that we save, and we can work someplace else.
Okay. Any other questions? I think this was a very instructive session. I also would note, highlight the comment that Mr. Doherty made. He's heading back to the FTA's TRACS committee, which is a national advisory committee. Both he and Jackie Jeter are members of that committee. And to hear that we are actually going to be presenting things as industry best practice is a big step forward from where we've been. We appreciate the efforts that have gone into that. If not, any other questions? If not, we'll adjourn the meeting.